Hi, this is Terry Kuzma at the Penn State NAC Center. I'd like to continue with Unit 5, Micro and Nanomaterials and Bioapplications. This is Lecture 2, and we're still taking a look at biocompatibility and cellular overview. So we're in this area here, quick overview and cellular. So we're taking a look at, really now what we're looking at is proteins and how proteins interact with the cell. So this is DNA to protein synthesis. So the DNA splits into form a pre-mRNA. And then what the body does is makes this mRNA. And what that's going to do is this is going to be what's expressed. This is the protein that's going to be expressed by that particular cell. Then what that does is it would take this mRNA, usually exports it like to the endoplasmic reticulum area. And then our good friend right here is the ribosome. And I always picture what the ribosome is. I mean, just as a cartoon, the ribosome to me looks like a snail. And so this snail rides along the mRNA, which looks like a railroad track to me. And what it does is it goes three railroad tracks, like ACA. And what this ribosome does, like this snail, it goes to the cytosol like it has an arm on it. And it grabs the appropriate amino acid represented by this codon. So this snail ribosome sees AUG, and it'll grow out and it'll grab the AUG amino acid. And then what that does, it spits out the protein that is the assembly of all these polypeptides put together. So that's what it looks like to me. So we have our friend the ribosome rides along the mRNA. It goes three data bytes. Each three data bytes encodes a specific amino acid. And then what it does with that amino acid is it assembles those into polypeptides. And then once the polypeptide is in water, then it folds to form the functionality of a protein. So once RNA is synthesized, it leaves the nucleus for the ribosomes in the endoplasmic reticulum. Transfer RNA, called tRNA, another kind of RNA, transfers the amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins, from the cell cytoplasm to the ribosome. So this, again, this is the transfer RNA. So on one side, it has the codon, the appropriate codon encoding. And then on the other side, what it's going to do is possess the appropriate amino acid. So it's the transition, the transfer RNA actually reads, with the help of the ribosome, reads the mRNA and gives the appropriate amino acid. So that's how these things interact. The tRNA, mRNA, ribosomes function together to synthesize the proteins. And again, this is a good example of how, you know, self-assembly takes place. So proteins, for some background, proteins are a major class of biomolecules that can directly connect biology to nanotechnology. Our bodies are 20% protein, and what proteins do is they allow us to think, feel, move, and function. Proteins come in many shapes and sizes, giving them many functions, and some of these functions could be catalysts of chemical reactions within cells. Certainly, they can act as cellular gatekeepers to open up those gap junctions, etc. They could be used for the immune system and monitor recognition of foreign cells so that they can identify what's appropriate in the body and what's not appropriate. And they give structural support to cells and tissues. So DNA itself has one function. It's the hard drive, right? But the protein itself, proteins have a myriad of functions and functionality within the body. Again, the DNA houses at least the memory or the data to make all the proteins, and the proteins themselves carry out all types of different functions within the body. So it's interesting that proteins are built from 22 types of amino acids, and each amino acid is about a nanometer in size, and an example of this is tryptophan as an amino acid, and I guess tryptophan's famous as the thing that's in turkey at Thanksgiving, so you eat a bunch of turkey and then you want to sleep, so this is the sleep amino acid or something like that. I don't know if that's true. I think it's that you just sat down and ate 6,000 calories of pumpkin pie and turkey and gravy and potatoes. I think that puts you to sleep too. But I'll go with the tryptophan story just as a man of science. But I still believe in the 6,000 calorie theorem. So the DNA also gives proteins information on how to assemble from amino acid building blocks, and proteins have highly variable structures and can change their shape in response to their surroundings in order to provide a signal. So they're very fluid. And, you know, how do they change the shape? You know, that's something that we'd like to answer. Proteins can provide binding sites for chemical reactions to occur, and proteins can identify cells. This is important for cancer because tumors can have identifying proteins, as we discussed before. And so this is, again, a picture that we referenced in the last lecture of, you know, how these proteins actually do cellular communication, how proteins are made within the body and then exported to perform some kind of cellular communication within the body. So this is how the body works. And again, these proteins in this area can actually identify this cell as being a liver cell or some other type of cell. And interestingly for us, maybe this protein, and this is just a cartoon, but the protein that's shown on the surface of the cellular wall, maybe this would be the protein that's expressed only in certain types of cancer. Or maybe this is highly expressed in a cancer cell. It might be somewhat repressed in a normally operating cell, but in a cancer cell, this might be very, very popular, like VEGF, which is a typically something that's very overly expressed in a cancer cell type of protein. So proteins themselves, how are they so complex? So I think it's very, very, very interesting and, you know, answers a lot of questions. The proteins, the amino acids themselves, the building blocks of proteins, the amino acids can be either hydrophobic or hydrophilic. So protein interaction establishes the cell's response to materials. Polypeptides contain both hydrophilic and hydrophobic amino acids. So it has both. Polypeptides will form in an fold in an aqueous solution. Once folded, polypeptides become proteins because a functional polypeptide is a protein, which are a vital part to biological processes. So the hydrophobic, hydrophilic nature of amino acids gives proteins the three-dimensional complexity. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, how do these proteins fold in these different fashions? And it's because when the polypeptides are being assembled, each link has either, you know, they like the water or they don't like the water. So they're going to be attracted to water or move away from the water. So that movement and interaction with water actually gives the polypeptides twist. So we can see this is a rather famous book, Molecular Cell Biology, by Lodish, and this is the book that I think is still currently used at Penn State. And when I went to Penn State University, this is the book I used for molecular cell biology, and it was a fantastic book, certainly a standard in the country. I think there's two or three major textbooks. This is one of them. And this shows the hydrophobic amino acid. So if we call up a codon, and it happens to be valine or cysteine or whatever, or glycine, then these guys are going to be hydrophobic amino acids on the chain. Then if a codon would happen to call up one of these, like lysine, this is going to be hydrophilic amino acids. So when you stack these together like little bubbles on a chain, then what these are going to do is they're going to give the protein functionality, because this twists the protein or the polypeptide into a three-dimensional shape because of the hydrophobic, hydrophilic nature of the individual links on that chain. So the hydrophobic, hydrophilic nature of amino acids allows polypeptides to twist and bend in water. So this really makes these proteins complex. This twisting and bending often defines the functionality of the proteins. Material response in some diseases are defined by a lack of a certain twist in a protein. So if we would have damaged DNA, then we would certainly have damaged RNA. And what the RNA does is it has the codons on there. So if the codon was damaged and it had the wrong A, G, C, T, or A on there, then that's going to give us the wrong amino acid. So when that amino acid is included in a polypeptide chain, it might not bend, or it might not bend at the correct angle. All of these hydrophobic or hydrophilic amino acids, they all have a certain ability or a certain amount of hydrophobic or hydrophilic to them. So some will bend more or less depending on the chemistry. So if they're still a hydrophobic, if it's a mistake and it's still a hydrophobic amino acid, it still is going to impact how the protein folds within the water. So this is the twist. And again, you know, a portion of the picture that we showed in lecture one, this shows us the amino acids. And again, these are going to be more or less hydrophobic or hydrophilic, these building blocks of the polypeptide. And then when we put these in water, they just fold and bend and twist. So they're like a three-dimensional key. So this is why biology is so complex, because this key is just really beautiful in its complexity. So that's going to do certain thing for us in the body. You know, it could, you know, open a port. It could be an antibody. It could be many things, you know. So this is really important. It could go and attach to a virus or something. So these things are really important in the body, and understanding how these things twist and bend into that structure is very critical to understand. So intercellular junctions, we mentioned this before and showed these on the slides. Neighboring cells often adhere, interact, and communicate through direct physical contact. There are three types of intercellular junctions in animal cells. There's tight junctions. These fuse together and they prevent leakage of extracellular fluid. There's desmosomes. These things anchor cells together. And then there's the gap junctions, which I referred to before. These guys pass salt, sugars, amino acids, and other small molecules between cells. So it's interesting to note that when we're looking at intercellular junctions, that cancer tumors often do not follow the rules of normal cells. So the cancer cells break the tight junction rule, and the blood capillaries are often leaky compared to normal tissue. So, you know, in early medicines, you know, that's one of the things they referred to in as tumors. They said they're bloody messes or bloody areas or whatever, because these capillaries were very leaky as compared to normal tissue. So tumors tend to be really bloody and stuff like that. And that's important, you know. And again, when I described before, there was tight junctions like epithelial cells in lecture number one. I described these as like shingles on a roof. At least that's how I have a cartoon in my head. I don't know if that's appropriate, but it helps me get my mind around the objective. So these look like shingles on a roof. In a normal cell, the shingles will be all aligned and it'll be pristine. And just like a roof that has all its shingles on there appropriately aligned, water can't leak in. So in a cancer shell, you'll be missing a shingle or two, because cancer is kind of dumb and grows fast and it doesn't follow all the rules. So it'll be like a leaky roof. And that's interesting, because this leaky roof concept and a tumor being leaky, we're going to take advantage of later on in the presentation to say, how can we selectively attack cancer? And we would have to identify, you know, in all cancer selection, if we want to apply a drug, what many cancer drugs do is they kill the cancer quicker than they kill the surrounding cells. So one thing that you might want to do just as a goal is say, how is cancer different than a normal cell? And how can we apply a drug differently than a normal cell? And this is one of the tenets, you know, a cancer cell is leaky. So if we could take advantage of if we can somehow deliver a drug to a leaky structure compared to a robust structure that has tight junctions, then we're going to be able to target cancer. So we're going to look how these attributes impact nanotechnology-based drugs later in the presentation. And certainly, I didn't want to pass by that point. This is a point that we're going to use throughout the rest of the presentation, that cancer breaks the tight junction rule. We're going to take advantage of that for a certain classification of drug delivery that utilizes nanotechnology so that we can actually target cancer preferentially to healthy cells that have tight junctions. So cell communication, certainly important. Cell membrane, which is the lipid bilayer, has many receptors, which we looked at, which receive chemical signals from other cells and the extracellular matrix. As we described before, a ligand is a molecule that binds with a receptor in order to induce a cellular response. Ligands can be a neurotransmitter, a hormone, a pharmaceutical drug, a toxin, a protein from other membranes, etc. So that's what they are. They're just a communication port. Proteins on a cell membrane serve as a marker identifying one cell to another or a specific environment within the body. A cell's response will vary depending on the type of cell and the ligand that's received by the cell. So cell-to-cell communication is vital for biological functioning. Therefore, we have to understand how cells communicate that is vital to a nanotechnology so material can properly engineer to do the proper cellular response. So let's take a look again at these cellular junctions and what they do. So cells adhere, interact, and communicate through these chemical signals. And these chemical signals are often proteins, right? So cell function conveys proper environment. And let's take an example of this. If we look at red blood cells, and if we would just examine, you know, what does a red blood cell do? Red blood cells, they need to flow in the body. So red blood cells should be moving in your body. If they bind in an area and they form a clot, then certainly the person is at risk because then you could have a stroke. So we don't want blood cells to bind and form a clot and form together. So the natural tendency, or what, you know, cells are designed to do through their communication ports, cells want to be moved, red blood cells want to be moving in your body. And if they're not moving in their body, what your body does is through apoptosis, they kill themselves. They dissolve. So if we have a clot, the clot, by definition, or through a healthy clot per se, if there is such a thing, what the clot should do, or the blood cells should do, is they shouldn't try to live and exist. They should kill themselves and be dissolved by the body. And that's what they do if they're in the right area. The muscle cells, likewise, if muscle cells are in the body, they are meant to be bond together. So they have communication that says, I'm a muscle cell. You're a muscle cell next to me. We're in the right environment. I deserve to be alive. I'm in the right environment. I'm contacting another muscle cell, and everything's good. So they carry out life's function in that entity. But if a muscle cell breaks off and it floats in your body like a red blood cell, then you really don't want to have this piece of, you know, this cell growing in your body where it's not supposed to grow. I mean, I guess you could define that as, per se, a tumor. You know, it would be a cell that doesn't know that, you know, to carry out the appropriate cellular function in the body. It breaks off as a rogue, and then it doesn't know to kill itself. It doesn't have that apoptosis thing. So I think those are things that you could say of cancer, that they don't, you know, cancer doesn't communicate with other cells and say, should I be doing the appropriate job? And because cancer is doing the appropriate job, so it doesn't have that ability to shut itself down. And it divides really rapidly. So that's another hallmark of what, you know, cancer cells do. So this communication, their cells carry not proper communication saying, like, I'm a red blood cell. Am I doing the right thing? Am I free flowing through the body so I'm not creating a clot? That's appropriate for a red blood cell to do. Likewise, a muscle cell says, am I actually, you know, bond to other muscle cells because I don't want to be free floating in the body like a red blood cell. So then at that point, if that cell is, you know, a normal cell, it would cease to function. So without these signals of where should I be and what should I be doing and communication with other cells, you know, you're going to form cancer. So these are important key things to think about. So materials must emulate the environment. They must interact with the environment and talk to the environment. And materials must emulate. If we put in a man-made material, we can't throw these communication things off for the cell. And then certainly another key take-home message here with junctions is this hydrophobic, hydrophilic interaction is a huge concern in how these proteins interact with cells. So before we start the next section, lecture three in this note packet, what I'd like to do is give us some vocabulary. You know, this fit nicer in with the cell portion of the presentation than it did the materials. But, you know, here's some, you know, discussing cancer and what's known about cancer or how can we describe cancer in a paragraph. So let's take a look at these different vocabulary words that are going to help us out in the next phase of our understanding of biomaterials. So cancer, it's known medically as a malignant neoplasm. It's a broad group of various diseases, all involving unregulated cell growth. And again, this is a key that the cell is dumb and doesn't know what it's doing, as I pointed out in the last slide. And cancer cells divide and grow uncontrollably, forming malignant tumors, and they invade nearby parts of the body. There's over 200 different types of known cancers that afflict humans. And they're, you know, some are common or have a lot of common traits with each other. And others are really diverse in how they carry out their goals of being a cancer tumor. So that's important to know that there's over 200 different types that afflict humans. This is interesting. And what would make a cancer? Well, certainly it grows uncontrollably. And, you know, key things that would make it grow uncontrollably is rapid cellular division. And we discussed that before, that the DNA has to divide to split into different halves so that, that the cell could divide into two halves and grow, right? So that's important. The other thing about cancer is, since cancer is forming, it needs to grow. And when it's growing, it's still going to need nutrients, et cetera. So when cancer grows, it actually has to provide blood. It has to provide capillaries to it. So one of the hallmarks of tumors is, and how you would spot, you know, a benign from a malignant tumor, benign being not the best thing in the world, but malignant being bad. But what a malignant tumor is the malignant tumor is growing rapidly, and what it needs to grow rapidly is a source of nutrients and blood. So what a malignant tumor would have is a source of new blood supply. So what the cancer would do is tell the body to form new capillaries. And certainly that's a hallmark of cancer, is that it always expresses that it needs blood flow, because it's acting like a damaged part of the body that needs repaired. So it's going to need more capillaries in it. So that's one of the hallmarks of cancer, is that it's always trying to get blood flow expressed to it. So another thing that we have to look at in the role of cancer and what it does in the body is the word metastasis. It's the spread of cancer to other locations in the body. These can include large lymph nodes, and these can be seen. It could be an enlarged liver and an enlarged spleen, because these lymph nodes, the liver and the spleen, what they're trying to do is they filter out foreign materials. So naturally, they're going to be working overtime because they're trying filter out the cancer. And certainly this can be affects the bones if there's pain and fracture in bones. And if you've known anybody with cancer, these are the hallmarks. And this is when it's cancer is really bad, when it's growing throughout the body. So if you have cancer in multiple locations in the body, that's very bad for the patient. So angiogenesis, this is an important thing, as I discussed before. What this is, it's the physiological process through which new blood vessels form from pre-existing vessels. Vascular epithelial growth factor, VEGF, again, this is a signal that I said is overexpressed in cancers, is a signal protein produced by cells that stimulates this angiogenesis. So this is what cancer does, that it overexpresses its VEGF because it has this desire to have blood grow to it, go to it, because it's growing so rapidly. So again, in our just additional vocabulary that's going to help us out in the next lecture, we're going to look at a ligand or ligand. It's a substance, usually a small molecule, that forms a complex with a biomolecule to serve a biological purpose. So it's like a lock and key. Ligands can direct particles. Ligands are a signal triggering molecule binding to a site on a target protein. Selective ligands have a tendency to bind to a very limited type of receptors, whereas non-selective can bind to several types of receptors. And then important, you know, again, this is, I wish we had, and certainly you have available to you at your institution, to take many courses on molecular cell biology or understanding of cancer and, you know, to pick out half a dozen vocabulary words and say they do our discussion justice is rather hard to do. But these are just a few words that would help us or a concept. So there's cancer expression as a vocabulary or a concept. So, you know, people have taken data from 22 tumor types, and they identified multiple metabolic expression changes associated with cancer. So, again, what we would like to do to heal cancer, you know, as nanotechnologists or help physicians handle or deliver drugs to specific areas is we would like to target that. So this is the targeting. So these, when they study these tumors, they could tell you how these tumors are different from the rest of the body. And now we could use these expressions, or we would say proteins, right? So these are proteins that identify tumors, and we could use that to maybe hone in on the tumors and selectively be able to deliver a drug. So I think of these things like, and again, as a cartoon to help me think, I think of these things as like a specific Velcro. So it's a different type of Velcro, and only one type of other Velcro would fit it and match, like a lock and key or a puzzle piece. So this is a special type of protein or special lock and key that's on the surface. So now what we can do with our drug is, if the tumor was the lock or expressed locks on it, as locks, the expression changes, what we could do is put some kind of key, the appropriate keys, on some medicine and then send them over, and those would bind. So that's how we're going to, you know, try to selectively, or one method that people use to try to selectively deliver drugs to cancer areas. And this is just for, because we're going to look at this as an example later in the next presentation. This is HER2. This is an epidermal growth factor receptor, and it's very common in, you know, breast cancer. It's in other cancers, but it's a very common gene or protein that we see that's expressed by breast cancer. So this is something that we could use. So this gene mutation and the elevated levels of this HER2 causes many types of cancer. It can occur in many types of cancer. This is a gene mutation that occurs only in cancer cells, and it's not a mutation that you can inherit from a parent. So this epidermal growth factor receptor is something that we could say differentiates, you know, types of cancer, especially breast cancer, from other types of cancer. There's actually an HER1, which isn't as aggressive as HER2, or the sign of HER2 terribly shows that you're going to have a real tough time with breast cancer. That's a really bad sign. It's only expressed in a smaller percentage. HER1 is in both types of breast cancer. I think this expresses one type of cancer that's especially terrible. So there's other ones that I guess people are familiar with, or just as a review, we might discuss later in the next presentation for reference. We'd go over it now. So there's a prostate-specific antigen, commonly known as PSA. This is normal in the body, used in procreation per se, but it's often overexpressed when there's prostate cancer. So there's some debate whether this always shows prostate cancer, which I guess it doesn't. But when it's overexpressed, that certainly could be a link to cancer. Again, I'm trying to identify, you know, common things that you might have seen before or discussed, you know, just in general of, you know, proteins and stuff that would identify cancer. And certainly a huge concept is this definition, the enhanced permeability and retention effect. So they commonly call this EPR. This is too tough to say all the time. But this is key, and this is really going to be, I guess, a huge idea in the next lecture. And we're going to use this in different forms. We're going to apply materials. This concept of EPR, we're going to take advantage of this concept and then take nanomaterials, because they actually, so nanomaterials, fit nice with this EPR effect. And this is how we're going to help, you know, alleviate some of the types of cancer by the EPR effect. So this is really critical to know. So let's go over the definition. It's the property by which certain sizes of molecules, which are typically liposomes, which we're going to be our first discussion in the next lecture, nanoparticles, and macromolecular drugs, tend to accumulate in tumor tissues much more than they do in normal tissues. So a goal here is certainly we want to kill the cancer quicker than we kill the surrounding normal tissue. And that's what we're going to do. And this EPR effect gives us that ability to do. Now we have to find the right material that will actually match with that effect. So particles can preferentially enter tumors because these newly formed tumor vessels are usually abnormal in form and architecture. This is what I was describing as a house and a roof on the house, and then the roof is missing some shingles. So that's my picture for this, and that's not literal, but as a, you know, cartoon in your head, we can say that, you know, cancer grows so readily. It's like a carpenter trying to put a roof on a house and trying to do it, you know, twice as fast as they should. They're going to make mistakes or miss shingles or whatever, and that's what cancer does. And then naturally, with the house analogy, you're going to have leaks in there, and that's what cancer is. Cancer is leaky. And again, that shows the missing shingle analogy, that you're going to have leaks not only in the roof, but you're going to have leaks in the tumor. So these newly formed vessels, which are usually abnormal in architecture, they have poorly aligned effective epithelial cells, like a roof missing a shingle. The increased retention is due to the lack of lymphatics around the tumor region, which would filter out such particles under normal conditions. So we can take a look at a tumor and say, or cancer, and say, what do we know about that? Well, what we know is that it is leaky. And we know that once a drug goes in, the drug doesn't want to come out because it really doesn't have a drain. So the lymphatic is a draining system that would take things out of the cancer. The cancer, again, is an abnormal cell. It wouldn't use the lymphatic system. So it's actually interesting that a lot of tumors that are positive pressure than the rest of the body of normal tissue, because they don't have drainage. And they have this strong desire to take up blood, et cetera. So they actually, it's hard to get a drug in to a tumor because it's slightly at a positive pressure compared to the adjacent biological material surrounding it. So I'd like to wrap up this portion of the lecture at this point. And so what we did is hopefully we successfully reviewed cellular interaction. And what was important is, you know, the scale, the size, and, you know, what does a cell do, and how does a cell communicate? And then now how do we apply materials, the man-made materials on the nanoscale that are going to communicate with those cells and the appropriate host response, right? So the biocompatibility of what we're going to do next. So in the next lecture, what we're going to do is we'll go over nanoscale materials for biological interaction, and we're going to take a look at liposomes, metal nanoparticles, nanoshells, and then just some other examples of how we would use nanotechnology for bioapplications. So certainly I think the next presentation is very interesting, and it's going to use a lot of the stuff that we reviewed in the first two presentations. So invite you to watch the next lecture, and I'm going to wrap it up for now. We'll see you next time. Bye.